I'm going to introduce all of our panelists really briefly. First, we have Anita. Anita, say hello. Zainab. And we have Sunny. And we have Justin. Hey. And we have Jasmine. And Noah. And we have Imam Muhammad. And so this week we're going to be talking about the military economy. And we're going to go ahead and throw it to Anita.
All right. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. So over the course of this Zoom call, we're going to be talking about the war economy, militarism, and reasons, whether it's moral, economic, religious, constitutional, reasons to be opposed to the war economy and to militarism. And I wanted to take a few minutes just to focus on where I personally come from in terms of religious and moral reasons to be opposed to the war economy. So I personally am Hindu, and a big belief that we hold sacred is that of ahimsa, which a means not in Sanskrit, and himsa means harm or injury. So it's really important in our faith tradition to remain nonviolent, because the idea is that we're all part of one kind of greater being, and so we can't harm others without also harming ourselves. That's the reason that a lot of Hindus are vegetarian. And when I'm talking to my own community of Hindu Americans, I find that talking about ahimsa in relationship to America's engagement in Syria or in Iraq or wherever is something that really resonates. So I think when people are thinking about how to engage with their own communities about war and the morality surrounding war, finding really powerful principles like that is tends to be successful, at least in my experience. And then purely morally going beyond religion, I think an important reason that we ought to be opposed to a war economy is that in our current economic system, success really equals growth. And from a moral perspective, we want to be reducing the amount of war and the amount of human suffering. So this system in which private companies profit off of that human suffering and are incentivized to actually increase that human suffering to fuel those profits, that system is immoral. And just to give you an example of that, in Afghanistan, compared to the first 9 months of 2016, there was a 52% increase of civilian deaths from airstrikes in 2017, with women and children comprising 68% of those deaths. That's really startling to know that the amount of airstrikes we are engaged in Afghanistan is only going up. And we as Americans should not be complicit in those civilian deaths from this moral perspective, where we ought to be actively engaged in reducing the amount of suffering in the world. And I just want to put in a quick word that it's possible to not support a war economy, but to support friends and family in the armed forces. You know, we need to understand that 53 cents of every discretionary dollar in our national or in our federal budget goes to fund the military. That's a huge amount. So it's important that we expand our analysis from individual choices to a critique of this kind of twisted system in which those individuals are just making the best choices they can for their families. And to leave you with just a couple more statistics that you can take out that I find really powerful when I'm talking to people about these issues. Army privates in combat earn less than $30,000 on average in 2016. And in that same year, in 2016, the CEOs of the top five military contractors earned on average $19.2 million, which is more than 600 times what those army privates are making. And that is just going to fuel those profits and which in turn is going to fuel that human suffering globally. And so from this kind of moral analysis, we really ought to be opposed to war, because war really just begets more war in our current economic system. That's the main takeaway that I want y'all to have.
Thank you, Anita. So again, if you're just joining us, this week we're talking about the war economy and how that negatively impacts our people. Anita just told us about, gave us a really good example of one reason why it's morally, why we should oppose it morally. Justin Jones is a guest panelist with us this week. And I know that you're in Divinity School in Tennessee.
Yeah, just starting at Vanderbilt.
Yeah, can you talk to us and give us more of that moral perspective?
Yeah, I'm Justin. I just want to show my shirt real quick. I got my shirt on from Ferguson that says unarmed civilian. When we went as a delegation to stand in solidarity with those organizing in Ferguson against the militarism that was happening here on our own soil against, you know, people who look like many of us of color who, you know, are opposed to the militarism of police. And so I just think that's something I want to lift up in this time as well, seeing what's happening in Nashville right now. We just had a police shooting a couple weeks ago. An African-American male was shot in the back of his head by one of our officers, an African-American male and a white officer. And we know that that violence is connected to the violence that's happening abroad, because the same training that these people have in Gaza, these Israeli military, the same training that these officers are getting in Nashville and Ferguson, in Oakland, where my family lives right now. And so just connecting that to this overall crisis of why it is that, as Tupac said, we got money for war, but we cannot feed the poor. And so I think one thing that's so concerning to me is that I've been watching the news today, and I've seen so much coverage over the craziness coming from our White House, and yet I've seen so little coverage of the moral atrocity of the airstrike of children in Yemen, a group of school children on a bus who were going on a field trip, and they were shot. Their bus was shot with the support of the U.S. military. And so I just think that's why it's so immoral, is that at my church, when I was growing up, we sang this song that Jesus loves the little children, all the little children of the world. And I think what's so distorted about a moral narrative now is that we've made it that God only loves certain children, you know, children that are born in America that are white. And if we're honest, that are rich and wealthy, that come from wealthy families. And that is immoral, that we've distorted our moral narrative to not be concerned about the children. All across, when we see the militarization at our borders, that's exactly what we're seeing. We're seeing a war waged against those who are coming here seeking relief from violence that was enacted by military that was often with U.S. support. If we look at the history of this nation, we saw the military in Standing Rock, and we saw it, you know, used against our indigenous brothers and sisters who are simply saying that, you know, we have to protect the water and our natural resources, and that's immoral for us to not care about the next seven generations. And so I guess that's something, you know, we look at in my faith tradition, as someone who is, you know, seeking ordination in the Methodist Church, as someone who identifies with the Christian faith, I think I cannot reconcile not speaking out against militarized violence, not speaking out against violence enacted by systems and governments, often in our name. And I think that clergy who are silent about those things should really examine what it is that they're really worshiping. Are we worshiping at the idols of, you know, I think it's so interesting that a lot of our people call ourselves, we live in one of the only countries where you can call yourselves pro-life while at the same time being pro-war and pro-gun and anti-refugee and you know, and pro, I just think it's so irreconcilable. And so I guess that's some of the moral concerns that I have as someone who's a millennial and looking at the future that we're hoping to build as a community. So I don't know if that answers, Kenneth, but that's what I got.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I do want to invite all of our audience, everyone who's watching, to not just be an audience, as a town hall. So if you post your comments, your questions in the comments, then we'll answer as many of them as we can. So please, you know, keep this conversation alive by engaging with us and adding to the conversation. Does anybody in the panel want to respond to kind of what Justin said? Okay. So then I will just go ahead and ask Imam Muhammad Abu Taleb. You can correct me if I'm saying your last name wrong, by the way. But can you talk to us about, from your perspective, what is the moral opposition to the war economy?
Certainly. Thank you, Kenneth. Pleased to be with all of you today. I serve as imam or religious leader of one of the large mosques, largest mosques in the Southeast United States. And as a Muslim, I think what's been shared by my fellow panelists really resonates with me about our moral obligations to be concerned for the plight of our fellow human being and to refuse the labels and divisions that are wedged between us that arbitrarily assign value to some human life and supposedly strip it from others, that judge people by items that are descriptive of themselves, but that they had no choice in, their gender, the color of their skin, the place that they were born, the place that they grow up, and use that as a reason to profit economically and politically and in terms of power through the plight of others. For me, I want to just reflect with you today on this embodied through one of my heroes, and I think a figure that captivated a lot of the fascination and ultimately, but not originally, admiration of the American public. And that figure, connects us also with the, the Poor People's Campaign and the Civil Rights Movement. Of course, our connection to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. occurs at a similar time, and that person is a person that I was always confused with as a young child in elementary school, Muhammad Ali. Every time my name was called, it wasn't as common when I was in school to have Muhammad. And so people would say that and say, oh, Muhammad Ali, because those were the two Muhammads that they knew on the planet. That was my first introduction to this man, but I didn't really know much about him or about the time, I was learning with a lot of fascination and a lot of concern about that very tumultuous and difficult period of our nation's history and a lot of those issues that we still find ourselves connected to today. And I want to just focus on one part of that narrative that's connected to our topic tonight, which was the sacrifice that he made for the war economy of his time. You see, all of us will remember his passing a couple years ago, and how celebrated he was, how many people were at his funeral, how many people were speaking about his legacy, how accepted he was in the public discourse. But you have to be a student of history to remember how unpopular that stand was during the height of the Vietnam War, when he refused to enter the war on moral grounds. He was, as he was throughout his life, principled, unapologetically Black, unapologetically Muslim, when the popular celebrity recipe for success for a lot of people was to leave especially your race behind and leave a lot of labels behind and seek the adoration and the acceptance of people. And, when he at a very young age, an age that is close or at the age of many people on this call, and at the height of economic success, at the height of fame, he famously said, quote, "If I thought the war was going to bring freedom and equality to 22 million of my people, they wouldn't have to draft me. I'd join tomorrow," end quote. When he refused to participate in the Vietnam War, he did so based on his virtues. He did so based on his moral compass. He did so based on his values. But what is forgotten by many is that in order to stand up for those values, he had to sacrifice immensely, just as many of the figures and giants of that period of time. He was stripped of his heavyweight title, and he gave up 3 years in his prime. I mean, you really have to pause and take a deep breath to understand what that means for an athlete. I mean, that's not like LeBron James sitting out 3 years now. That's like sitting out 3 years during the Miami Heat days, right? I mean, 3 years at the peak of his physical strength in his prime. And so he lost a ton of financial earning. He lost a lot of popularity. But it was interesting that at his passing, a sportscaster became choked up on national TV asking how many athletes would do this, how many would give up everything for something that they believed in, for their moral, ethical, social, and political values and their views. And in the end of his monologue, he replied, "There was only one." In a sense, that is an inspirational and powerful story. It's a story that connects us to the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. It's a story that connects us to so many of the shapers of history that we are studying and looking into as we look for a compass and guidance on how to navigate our times now. But thankfully, many of us are not asked for that level of sacrifice. We're not asked for that level of courage. We're not asked to shoulder that level of burden as individuals alone. But I think as we look at our generation, you know, I've got my congregation convinced that I'm, you know, in my mid-50s, but I actually am a millennial, I promise. But as we look at that responsibility, it seems the challenge of our generation is simply to care, to stay connected, to be moved to a connection and positive engagement and action in a time when apathy is the norm, and in a time where there's too much bad news and too much difficulty to stay connected and stay concerned. It's really concerning, and I think it would hurt many of the pioneers and contributors, those with famous names and those who are just simply on the ground during the civil rights era. I think it would really hurt them to see that the plight of refugees today is undoubtedly immensely worse, a heavy cost of the war economy, where we have now the largest number of refugees and displaced individuals in the history of humankind. I think it would really hurt to see, even with the lessons that should have been learned during the incredibly costly wars of the 20th century, to see now a new era of seemingly unending wars with continually increasing civilian and human costs, that we have these wars now that are funded by shadow contributors and end up in stalemates and proxies. We have these never-ending wars that never draw down, and where the rich continue to profit, and the plight of the poor continues to get worse. And we have people that grow up in these circumstances, in the most abject poverty, without opportunity, without access to, you know, things that are necessary and should be expected for our human survival and for our human dignity, and sadly, ultimately come to fuel the very same problems that these wars purportedly are meant to solve, and which the data and studies show that they're not. And so I'm encouraged by the presence of everyone today, of the contribution of the panelists. And if I can leave you with a thought from one of my heroes, Muhammad Ali, it's to continue to care and be engaged and to contribute something, to say no to apathy and to contribute even if it's small, because even if people don't appreciate it today, ultimately people's moral compass overcomes and people will appreciate when you take a stand for what's right. Thank you.
Thank you, Imam. I do just want to follow up, because as you were speaking, we had a question about from one of our Facebook audience members about what is a way that we can combat apathy. And I think just kind of the way that you kind of ended your remarks, can you speak to not just the person who asked that question, but to all the panelists and to everyone, like, what can people do to the people that they know in their lives who are not thinking about American imperialism, who are apathetic about the war economy. Like, what can be done to raise that consciousness?
Yeah, it's a great and broad question. A couple points come to mind as starting points. And one point is the importance that consciousness is fueled by education and information. When you look at the audit that's been completed as part of the Poor People's Campaign, and you engage those statistics, some of which are being shared tonight, but many more are available through reading and through information. That information is power, and it fuels that connection. It combats that apathy, because you're not as prone to the talking heads on TV, to the quick headlines that are not rooted in fact and not rooted in reality. And that's hard work, honestly. In a social media age, in the 24-hour news cycle with so much noise around, to make a conscientious effort to be informed, to insist on not just some talking headlines, but to really be rooted in fact, takes engagement, it takes desire, it takes work, but the beauty is it's out there. I mean, now it's not controlled by a single media outlet, it's not controlled by those in power. That information is out there for those that want to obtain it. But another piece, and there are more, but these two, you know, come to mind as cornerstones, is the not just the importance of education, but the importance of relationship as well. When I am not in relationship with my fellow human being, even if I don't have access, if you have access to travel internationally and being exposed, that's wonderful. But if not, to do the necessity and the bare minimum of being connected to one's neighbors, of connecting to people on campus, of engaging with people of different faith traditions, of different backgrounds, of understanding what people hold dear and sacred and what motivates them. When I am in relationship with my human being, my fellow human being, I not only gain the tools to see how much we share in common, but indeed to build the tools of empathy and how to engage our diversity and differences with class and with respect. Regretfully, the xenophobia and the absurd levels of racism that we thought were a thing of the past, but appear to have just been hiding until it became okay to do it on TV and in public. These are concerning indicators of the state of our hearts and our moral compasses, to really be in relationship with others so that we are not prone to that most basic human instinct. And it is only human to fear that which is not known. So when we are not connected with our fellow human being to a level that we will believe outright lies on TV, outright unfactual and false statements, fear-mongering, political, you know, manipulation, that indicates that we are disconnected at a very alarming level from those that are all around us, our colleagues and our friends and our friends on, and our colleagues on campus.
Thank you. And I know, Anita, do you have any thoughts on this? I mean, this is why we're having this conversation right now. And if you're watching, live, please do share this so that you can help fulfill this purpose of addressing that apathy. But Anita, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I definitely agree with everything Imam Muhammad said. And I definitely think we need to be understanding that people around the world aren't, you know, separate from us, that us versus them mentality is definitely damaging in terms of war. But I think in order to get people interested in these issues and to stop being apathetic, even if you can't get them to think really deeply about imperialism, maybe they're just trying to get through their day-to-day lives, we need to connect the dots for these people that poverty is related to war, that inequality in our own country is related to the human suffering that is taking place outside of our borders. And to give that statement more concrete facts, more than 23,000 active duty troops used the food stamp program in 2013, which means that this war economy isn't even supporting the troops who are using that as their jobs. And 53 cents, I already said this, but 53 cents of every discretionary dollar in the congressional budget goes towards the military. And that's money that's not going towards Medicare for all. That's money that's not going towards social net, social safety net programs that we desperately need in this country. So if we talk about those issues before we even get to this, you know, expansive idea about imperialism, I think we can reach a lot of people that way as well.
Absolutely. And so I do, I want to get our other guest panelists in on this conversation. So we have with us Noah Rubin Blose. You had to take your mute off and correct me because I've known you for a while and I just don't call you by your last name ever. But we also have Jasmine Williams. And so Noah, why don't you first explain what organization you work with, and Jasmine, you too, and then can both of you just give a little bit of kind of your reaction to that question of breaking the apathy and raising consciousness?
Yeah, so my name is Noah Rubin Bliss, and it's really great to be here with y'all. So I am a member of the Jewish Voice for Peace Triangle North Carolina chapter, and here also as part of the Demilitarized from Durham to Palestine campaign. So our Jewish Voice for Peace chapter was part of a coalition with 10 local organizations that were working on this campaign, which I'll talk more about in a minute, but maybe Jazz, if you want to introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm Jasmine. I am one of the board members for BYP 100, which is another coalition member of the Durham to Palestine campaign.
Yeah, so I think that in thinking about this just question about the apathy, and I think what the other panelists are speaking to is like the lack of connection that a lot of Americans might feel to what's happening in other parts of the world and to militarization. For me, one of the things, as somebody who's been organizing on international issues since I was in high school, that it's really important to have concrete, and even if they're small victories, but I think it can feel really overwhelming to think about what the U.S. military is doing and what we can do about that. Like, I remember protesting against the war in Iraq when I was in college, and just being like, well, I can go to this big protest in DC, but it's not really going to do anything. And it's, I think it's really important for us to show our opposition, but also that, so what we did with this campaign, the Demilitarized Durham to Palestine campaign that we won in April, it was a campaign to pass a policy for the city of Durham to pass a policy prohibiting police exchanges between the city of Durham and the Israeli military and Israeli police. And what they ended up passing was actually a policy statement that prohibits exchanges between the Durham police and any foreign military, which Israel's the only one, as far as we know, that they had done an exchange with, but it prohibits any of that. And I think it's just really important to have these victories that are chipping away at that system that we can be a part of, and that are based in our own moral and spiritual, in the moral and spiritual imperatives that we have to impact the big picture and to change the world and challenge militarization locally and globally, but to be doing that in ways that are have concrete impacts on people's lives as well. So yeah, I mean, I guess to just say a little bit more about the campaign, it was about 2 years that this coalition of 10 groups were working on it, and it's an interfaith and multiracial coalition. And so for me as a Jewish person, I think like other folks have spoken to from their own faith perspectives, that, you know, there's some of the Jewish values that I hold really dear. Are around, we say tikkun olam, which is repair of the world, and tzedek, which is justice. And one of the morning prayers that we say is around being grateful for being made in God's image. And I hold really dear that that the fact that we're all made in God's image, and that means every single person on the planet. And so for me, that has meant challenging militarization, challenging racism and white supremacy, challenging oppression in all of its forms, and specifically also reflecting on the Israeli apartheid and Israeli occupation of Palestinian people, and wanting to make sure to challenge that. And especially as somebody who is a US taxpayer, to also be challenging that, not only as a Jewish person who's opposed to it, but just as a US taxpayer, who that means that my tax dollars are also going, $3.8 billion in aid, military aid a year goes from the US to Israel, and that a lot of that goes back to US weapons manufacturers, like folks we're talking about. So that we really have a responsibility to be challenging that. I don't know, Jess, do you wanna say a little bit more?
Yeah, I've noticed that in a lot of the conversations that I've had surrounding the campaign and just in general, especially in talking about like what happens with the lives of poor people in this country and globally, that people hold a lot of assumptions, and there's a lot of conversations that are not being had that is directly hindering, or that is adding to this apathy that we're seeing. As somebody who is a Black Muslim minister who goes around in the South, I feel like a lot of people are usually really confused about how my life intertwines with that of people in Palestine and people globally. But as a daughter of a veteran, watching my father go through what he did, still carrying that weight, and watching the lack of benefits that we received throughout the years, it's not only affected the way I've been able to move throughout the world, but it's also affected the way that I'm able to contribute. And I feel like it's important to note that this isn't just on like a community organizing level, it's also on like a day-to-day basis. This goes down to sometimes I can't pay my bills and I'm asking for friends through Facebook, and that happens quite regularly. And I think it's like the assumption of like there's still that long-held assumption of like the bootstrap theory, that if you just pick yourself up, but it's important to note that a lot of the militarization that we've seen going on, including in Durham, has contributed to stripping away the necessary social services that we need in order to be able to do any of those things. I know one of the things that's currently going on in Durham is moving towards participatory budgeting. There's only like a couple million dollars going to that. And I mean, it sounds like a lot, but when you look at like how that's going to be split up operationally, that's nowhere near enough. Especially when you look at like what's going towards the military. And when I think of that, I think of like all the food that we could have used, like, so food stamps, I think of making sure we had transportation, making sure that textbooks were taken care of, like little things. And like, once you have these conversations with people and really break it down into like a way that people can understand. So instead of like, I mean, I do have a lot of like different conversations, but like once I like really break it down of like, hey, this is actually concretely what this means. A lot of people usually have some sort of shift. And I feel like that's where we need to be making that connection. So yes, on a global mass level, we need to have this conversation, but also like, let's talk about what this looks like for poor people. And what this looks like for poor people is that both here and globally, people are getting increasingly militarized. People are facing more brutalization. People are dealing with more state-sanctioned violence that is being widely like washed away, like being swept under the rug. And so and having the conversation about the campaign, I think what was unfortunately lost on a lot of people in the community was that this isn't just about Palestine and Israel, but this is about us as well. I know that one of the things I was concerned about was sending our police to exchange information with anybody. Like, I wouldn't want US police giving information about how to do anything that they're doing, because I know that it's based on a corrupt system that's actively still taking from slavery, that's actively still rooting itself in white supremacy, that's actively still protecting all of these systems that we need to get done away with.
Yeah. Can anyone else speak on that point? I think Jasmine really kind of hit the nail on the head when it comes to apathy. When people kind of recognize the direct connection or the direct impact that it has on their own lives, and maybe some people don't even realize that impact, what are some ways that that we can help raise that that connection and help people see that? Or another question would be back to Jasmine or Noah, what are some ways, looking back at the demilitarized Durham campaign, what are some ways that you see for people who are trying to do the same thing, or communities that have the same challenge put in front of them, where their police force is looking into this kind of exchange? What are ways that they can take advantage of that missed opportunity to make those direct connections?
I know one of the most direct ways is having conversations with the people that we put into office and the people that decide who gets to have control over what goes on in our policing system. I know one thing that Durham does that I really appreciate is that we have a lot of people that hold the like police chief and the sheriff accountable for the work they do, both good and bad. And I think that was a lot of what made them uncomfortable when we had this conversation about this statement. Like, I know for a fact, like, that was something that they really tried hard to diminish in the process of like, oh, well, we only did this one time, and we're definitely very careful about what we said, and we were very intentional about sticking to facts, but it still scared them so much. And I feel like understanding that we have that power over them and that we can also like go and have those conversations with them is really important. I think also looking at where the money goes, like trying to figure it out, which might be a little bit trickier, which I know from experience, like we've tried to look at, you know, where money comes in and where money goes from like the contracts made with the jail, for instance. And it's a lot of interesting like sideways like deals that have been made. And once you are able to see that, it's easier to like therefore like share that with the community, and the community therefore feels more invested in wanting to take that back because they know, hey, this isn't going to us, even though it's supposed to be. Where is the money that we need? I know a lot of the conversations I had recently, especially around the participatory budgeting, a lot of people were like, well, I want this money in my pocket, which I totally feel for. But a lot of these people don't have the time to go and talk to these officials, so they don't know what's going on. And so this is definitely like a call to action for people who do have that time, who do have those resources to go and make that effort.
And yeah, just to add a couple of things. I mean, I think that a couple of things that we did do during the Demilitarize Durham to Palestine campaign that I think were really powerful and other folks could also do is, so we had a petition drive and we were out on the streets and at different events and in well-trafficked areas collecting signatures and talking to people about these issues. And I think Yeah, I mean, I think we got different responses from folks in the community. And some of this was, you know, when the Great March of Return was happening, where Palestinians in Gaza were marching in an unarmed march to the fence that Israel has put up to delineate Gaza from Israel. And then the Israeli military was just like gunning people down. And yeah, and I think a lot of people just are really horrified by that. And so it was an opportunity to get to talk about that. And then, and we did these public art installations, and we, with that, we talked about state violence and what does state violence look like here, and particularly around policing, and what police violence looks like, and what militarized violence looks like in that sense. And then also what does Israeli state violence look like? And we had quotes from different activists, both here and around the world, around resistance and what resistance looks like. And just got a lot of responses from people walking by that they weren't seeing those connections being made in other places. And I think I think art is just a really beautiful way for people to be able to process hard topics and complicated topics and topics that are really heavy. So I think that was important. And I think it was a space where I know I had several conversations with folks who were like, oh, you know, this is my experience with police violence. Like, this is what that has looked like in my life. And so like being out on the street with art, I think can be a way for people to get to share their own stories too, about the ways that they've been impacted by these things.
Thank you. Thank you, Noah and Jasmine. Again, if you're watching, this conversation that we're having is about the war economy. And feel free to comment with your questions in the comment section to keep this dialogue going. And so we're going to go ahead and move to William. We've been talking about the moral opposition to the war economy and the various ways that this moral opposition has been expressed through many different faiths. William, can you talk to us about the legal opposition to the war economy? Hang on, everyone. Let's see how long it takes him to realize that he's on mute. Oh, he's not on mute. We're just having an audio issue. Let me see. We still can't hear you. Okay, so why don't we try this while we're working on that? We do have a couple of questions. One is, so the military has gotten worse from Bush to Obama to Trump, or militarism has gotten worse from Bush to Obama to Trump. How long can this continue? And we can't spread our military around the world forever. I mean, it's a good question. Does anybody want to comment or respond to that?
I guess I could get the conversation going with just a comment about history. What's interesting is that you look historically, and this not certainly only the imperialistic tendencies and so on and trends, but particularly this massive global presence and machine that's very expensive and very costly, not just in economic terms, but many other terms as well, is really assembled in a post-World War II reality, right? And that's where you really see the huge uptake in bases and presence all across the world. And then obviously after the Cold War, rather unchallenged as a superpower. what's amazing is that for all of the political differences and all of the changing challenges in the landscape, that each successive administration does not really see any benefit in dismantling this massive presence or even scaling it back in any sizable or speakable way. And that's really takes a moment to swallow, because you're talking about huge political differences and people that don't agree on many, many, many topics. And I think the question of how long can this continue is an alarming and necessary question, because the costs are becoming increasingly untenable. And in particular, the very questions at the foundation of the morality of war and war decisions, and there are actually now some research theses that are happening in, you know, the law field and sociology field about people really struggling with, you know, decisions where you are putting up unmanned craft and dealing with, you know, the inevitable human consequence of non-military deaths as well. And so I don't mean to summarize them in a line. I'm really raising questions for thought and discussion more than answering it. But I find this to be a very profound and alarming question, that this is really constructed for a very different time under very different realities, for threats that are no longer present in that regard, right? The concerns and after World War I and World War II. And yet there is not even any reasonable discussion about scaling this back. You don't really see that gain traction in the election cycles or debates. And so I think this question needs a lot more prominence in our political discourse in the country.
Thank you. Does anybody else want to respond to that question of how long American militarism can continue? Okay. We have another question. If one of the panelists can speak to the relationship between militarism and capitalism.
I can a little bit, Kenneth.
Go for it.
I think this is also kind of a response to the previous question in terms of how long can this continue. It's really about how long we are putting major profit for private billionaires over the lives of Black and Brown people across the world and in the United States, because what we are seeing and is this insidious trend of what profit looks like and why we are where we are putting money and who we are giving that money to. As Jasmine was talking about earlier, there is an insidious scheme that is about privatizing and waging war just to make the rich richer. And so how long militarism is going to be, I mean, we definitely have a moral defect of imperialism and of US-centric superiority, but it is also about making money. And that is how long, I think the question is, how long are we going to ties profiting for the rich. I can go into a lot of details and facts about this, Kenneth, but I'm not sure if we need to talk about that more before William gave the legal opposition to the war economy. I should go ahead and go into that.
William, how's it going over there? Okay, so we're gonna go with Sunny for a second on the economic opposition, and I think I got a workaround for William. But Sunny, can you go ahead and explain to us what the economic opposition to the war economy is?
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. So yeah, like many of us said, this is an insidious scheme that is about waging war just to get rich. It is a lie that the massive US defense budget has to actually do with defending the United States or any people in the United States or out and not in the United States. Especially over the last 50 years, if you just follow how drastically we have expanded our military budget, you can just see how it's quickly uncovered where our actual interests lie. What we are actually, or what the US government and our addiction to militarism actually reveals, is that we just want US corporations' control over oil, gas, and other resources and pipelines. We want to supply the Pentagon with military bases and strategic territory to wage more war and to maintain military dominance over any challenger, and to provide some sort of justification for our multi-billion dollar military industry. So we have something called the military-industrial complex. We can talk about it in all sorts of different terms, but basically what that means is we are trying to get military contractors, private contractors mostly, as much money as possible. Currently, the last number that we have is from 2017, that military contractors make $320 billion a year. That's the number from 2017. And that is taxpayers' money that is coming from the defense budget. So when we say military industrial complex or capitalism or war economy, all of these things mean that we are creating a narrative that says that we need war all the time. We need to be funding war. But really what that means is we need a reason to have war to make money. And that's what people are, why we need such a big military budget. So when people's personal wealth, like these private military contractors, is reliant on military spending, of course there's a motive to support pro-war, pro-militarization, pro-policing policies. And that industry is thriving right now. I'm just gonna throw you a couple of statistics that are just scary. In 2016, the CEOs of the top five defense contractors earned a combined total of $96 million in compensation, or an average of $20 million. And that is more than 90 times the $214,000 earned by a US military general with 20 years of experience that same year, including housing allowances and extra combat pay. So I think Jasmine was talking about their family and the way that they have experienced how veterans and people who are actual generals or soldiers themselves do not actually reap any of the benefits of this huge military budget. The huge military budget is meant for the private corporations that are profiting off of this. Army privates in combat obviously risk their lives much more than the CEOs or even the generals, who are making more for that matter. They earned less than $30,000 a year in 2016. So if you just think about what that $30,000, less than $30,000 a year in 2016, and the average $20 million that a CEO from a private defense contractor made. Those are just some really scary numbers, and it shows you where is this money going. Something else that we wanted to talk about in terms of private military contractors, this is a very little known thing. I didn't know it until I was doing research just for this town hall. But the very soldiers that we have on the ground are supplemented by other soldiers called private military contractors, where as a government have, or the US government does not acknowledge the amount of people that whose lives we're putting on the line, who are actually part of private military contracting companies and not actual soldiers that are employed by the US government. So since 9/11, a total of over 1500 private contractors working on the Department of Defense contracts were also killed in Afghanistan. But that number is something that people do not talk about, that the US government does not recognize, because they are not US military soldiers. These are also all of these sources, if are can be found in the Poor People's Campaign audit. This comes specifically from an article that I can share the link with if any of our listeners are wanting to. And then lastly, I wanted to talk about the way that these private contractors, or the presence of these private contractors, the private military soldiers, how their number, the invisible number that the government doesn't let us see, actually makes citizens or us believe that our presence in other countries fighting wars is not as big, when really there are many more soldiers that are unaccounted for. So it can hide the footprint that we're leaving. So we can say often that we are dwindling our presence in Iraq or Afghanistan, for example, and yet the vast number of civilian private military contractors are still there. And then I wanted to talk about one last thing, which is who is actually making money, and who is actually going to war for us. One of the most important predictors about military service and people who go to the military is socioeconomic status and family income. The people who are fighting our wars are the people who very most likely have less opportunities, fewer opportunities to do anything else. It is a way that the US government has advertised to low-income Black and Brown people to go into the military and fight our wars for us. But them going into the military as soldiers or as combatants isn't a ladder out of poverty or out of any hardship like we talked about earlier, because the people who end up fighting these wars are actually stay living in positions that are economic positions and otherwise hard positions to live in. So for example, in 2016, the Government Accounting Office reported that in 2013, 23,000 active duty military troops were receiving food stamps. So they are living in poverty also. And finally, I think this is something that really impacted me when I read it, is that a study from the Economic Policy Institute found that if the federal minimum wage were raised to $15 an hour, which is something that we are advocating for, by 2024, one out of every five veterans, which is almost 2 million people, would get a raise. And I think that just shows you how many people are living or making an unlivable wage right now, surviving on an unlivable wage, and two, how many of those people are veterans. Thank you.
Thank you, Sunny. It looks like we are not gonna be able to hear William's voice orally, but we are still gonna be able to hear William's voice through some text communication that he sent me. Because I think that the legal opposition to the war economy is something that we can't skimp on in this town hall. So just some notes that he sent me that I think are worth thinking about and discussing if we have, if anyone has like really short thoughts after I read these. The critical underpinnings of the nation's separation of military power from the democratic governance, meaning the armed forces should be subject to constitutional constraint. You can look at Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11, which grants Congress the power to declare war. I think a lot of people are familiar with that. But there's also Article 2, Section 2, which names the president commander-in-chief of the armed forces and has been interpreted to give the president special war powers able to direct the armed forces in certain circumstances. But it's something the nation should continuously check in order to prevent abuses of unilateral orders from military intervention, which we've seen a lot of in the past decade. The military-industrial complex has now become a burgeoning industry, and as such, are now continually engaging in marketing strategies to justify its continued existence. How is this done? By continuing to stoke the narratives of post-Cold War enemies, hence the War on Terror, hence the concept of rogue states, hence the continued exportation of arms to regimes across the globe. If you think there's value in that, yeah, then that's something that we should continue to raise up and discuss and point out, because there's legal grounds to challenge the military interventions and the war economy. Does anyone have anything to add to that? Okay, I do want to just say that we've got to wrap up, and I will wrap up by inviting all of our audience to continue to post comments and questions in the comment section. We'll continue to reply to them as long as we can to keep this vital conversation going. And join us August 21st at 7:30 p.m. We're going to be talking about poverty. So again, share this video with all of your Facebook friends and get the word out about this conversation on the war economy. And look out for more information about the in-person town hall that we'll be having. Continue to check the Poor People's Campaign Facebook page, and also follow the Poor People's Campaign on social media so that you can get those notifications more quickly. You can go to thepoorpeoplescampaign.org and sign up with your email if you want to get information that way. So thank you all for joining us tonight. Thank you to the panelists and to our guest panelists for sharing your thoughts and being bold enough to share your experience. We need to continue this conversation, and I thank you for being the ones to do it. So thank you and good night.